All right, we'd like to begin, please. I guess I should do the usual, please silence all pagers and cell phones. Sarah Tzipora Bat Shalom Yehuda Edelman was a beautiful, intelligent, loving, caring, and capable woman. She was bubbly, vivacious, gregarious, and greeted everyone with an infectious smile. She excelled in school and in the workplace and connected with her fellow students, employers, and colleagues. Everyone who knew her recognized her strong personality, her contagious laughter, her loyalty to friends, co-workers, and family, her work ethic, and fun-loving nature. We now have two grandchildren who have been named after Sarah. Shani and Paul's son, Chagai, and Yitzi and Chaya's daughter, Tzipora Hila. I know she would be very proud of both of her nephews and her niece, and she is kvelling with that these precious children are carrying on her legacy. We love Sarah very, very much. We will miss her every day for the rest of our lives. We are doing our best to preserve her memory in other ways as well. The Sarah Edelman Memorial Fund is a 501c3 organization designed to help Orthodox children in the St. Louis area in need of counseling, to increase awareness of depression, and to help everyone recognize the warning signs of suicide. We also use some of the funds to help local families defray the costs of their weddings. We would like to publicly thank Linda Cohen and Merle Hartstein for serving on the board of the Sarah Edelman Memorial Fund and for their input, advice, and time on the board and contributions to the fund. Thank you also to all the donors to the fund. With your contributions, we have been able to provide counseling for many children in our community and have also helped fund several local weddings. Thank you also to Linda Markowitz and Nadine Missler for helping in the lobby, and to David Markowitz for the sound system. Thank you all for coming. Your financial support of the fund, as well as your love and support of our family, has helped kept us going. Now I would like to introduce Rabbi Dr. Reuven Bulka. He has been the spiritual leader of Congregation Machzike Hadas in Ottawa since 1967. Rabbi Bulka is an accomplished author of more than 30 books and countless articles in the fields of religion, health, and psychology. He is also the host of a radio program and contributes to a newspaper article. He received his smicha from Rabbi Jacob Yosef Rabbinical Seminary in New York and his PhD concentrating on the logotherapy of Viktor Frankl from the University of Ottawa. We've all enjoyed his many talks this weekend, and I've enjoyed his company at our table, along with his wife. And I hope you will enjoy his talk this evening. The title is, Are We As Happy As We Should Be? Rabbi Bulka.
Thank you very much, Jan and Ed. First off, I would like to share with you that I feel privileged to, in some way or other, be involved in your extraordinary endeavor to perpetuate the memory of your dear Sarah. I unfortunately didn't know her, but I stand here in great admiration and salute you for your courage, for your determination, for your perseverance, and for doing whatever you can to make sure that she is never forgotten. I also thank you very, very, very much for the gracious hospitality over the course of the time that I have been here. It's been a really great delight. I thank you both for that. I thank also the President for hosting me in his Hilton residence, together with Renee. And of course, it was a great pleasure to reunite with my dear and beloved friend, Rabbi Moshe Shulman, after a few years of hiatus. I also thank the entire community for the extraordinarily warm welcome. Actually, it's a brutally hot welcome. But my wife and I are grateful. The question, are we as happy as we should be, is phrased specifically because I want to deal with social trends as opposed to individual instances. And some people may wonder why a topic like this, when we're on the threshold of entering into the 9 days, which are days that are as close to melancholy as it gets, actually is melancholy. Why speak about happiness in a sad time? Well, let's begin with something that may not be so obvious to all of us. We do not have in the Torah any sad days. There are no mandated sad days in the Torah. There are sad times, unfortunately. We learned, of course, of the passing of Aaron's children. Certainly was not a happy day. But to specifically delineate a day and say, this is sad, we don't have. There is none. The Omer period that we today think of as no weddings for 33 out of the 49 days, in the Torah time, it was happy time. It was the joyous build-up from Pesach to Shavuot. It was extraordinarily happy. The 3 weeks didn't exist. Tisha B'Av didn't exist. The 17th of Tammuz didn't exist. We lived happily. As a matter of fact, we were mandated to be happy. V'samachta v'chol hatov, it's a mandate in the Torah that we're obligated to be happy. V'samachta v'chagecho, we have to rejoice in the festivals, which according to the Gaon of Vilna is actually the hardest mitzvah to fulfill, because according to the way he understood it, it meant that you're not allowed to allow even the smallest amount of sadness into those Yomim Tovim, into those festivals. So we are, in the Torah, we're surrounded by happy times. Not only that, but it goes a little bit further. The type of things that we would associate with unhappiness usually are things like pain. Pain, aside from anything else, never mind historical stuff, pain interferes with our ability to enjoy. So when we're in pain, we can't really experience life in its fullness. There is no mandate for pain in the Torah either. There is nowhere in the Torah that it says as a mitzvah you have to go through a certain pain. And even if you take a look at the three mitzvot that sort of skirt on the edge of pain, it's very clear that we don't really appreciate them as pain mandates. So the one that we would think of perhaps first is the obligation to do a brit on a child at the 8th day. That, if anything, is designed so that the pain should be as minimal as possible. Because by rights, a brit should be when the child is compos mentis and knows to be able to say, yes, I'm entering into a covenant. But we enter the child into the covenant prematurely at the age of 8 days when they have no idea what a covenant is all about. The bar mitzvah is actually a reaffirmation of the brit. But by rights, it should have been done on when they became bar mitzvah. Can imagine if this would be the case. Why is this so? Because the earlier you have it, after a certain amount of time, the less the pain the child feels. You have another instance, of course, the mitzvah of pru urvu, the mitzvah to be fruitful and to multiply, which, according to most women, is not the most pleasant of experiences. Yes, it's exhilarating afterwards, but you go through pains, it's labor pains. It can be very excruciating. And interestingly, the Torah never told women that they have to have children. The mitzvah to have children rests squarely on the shoulders of the man. And it's Meshech Chochmah, I think, who says that the reason for this is because the Torah didn't want to mandate having to go through pain. So the woman was exempted from the mitzvah, not because she doesn't count and not for all other silly reasons that people may divine as to why this is the case. It's simply because God refused to say, you have to go through pain. You want to have children, fine, but I'm not putting you through them. It's your choice, it's fine. And finally, Yom Kippur. We have a word in the Torah which seems to indicate that we have to have some sort of affliction on Yom Kippur. Ta'anu et nafsho teichem, which is to say you should be afflicted. But I somewhat jokingly say to people, you can't be serious as to saying that you have to have an obligation to go 25 hours experiencing the pain of hunger. Because the time of the year when you can bet your bottom dollar that every single member of the shul attending is full to the gills is on Kol Nidrei night. Nobody comes into shul on Kol Nidrei night hungry. And on Yom Kippur night, people are more than satiated. They're probably overfull in anticipation of the big day tomorrow. So they sort of vitaminize themselves, make sure that they are full. So if we interpret this to mean that for 25 hours you have to be in the pain of hunger, it's obviously wrong. So there's another understanding for it, which means basically denial of food to ourselves so that we focus on other things. But it's very clear, those are the three that come closest to mandated pain, but again, in the Torah, there's no such thing. So, we, by virtue of this introduction, I would just like to say to you that this is not a course in comparative religion, but it's fair to say that we stand out in many ways, and one of the ways we stand out more than any is in our embrace of the obligation to have what's known as Simchat HaChayim, to have the joy of life. So much so that the Talmud tells us that in the spirit of melancholy, Ein Hashkina Shorah. With melancholy, you can't find godliness. You need to have a happy spirit. That's the way it is. And for a faith, for a religion, a way of life, to embrace this is unique amongst the faith systems. Unfortunately, some of the variations and the sort of versions of Judaism that have crept into our history have actually missed the boat on this and have created basically generations of miserable people whose worship of God has been associated with asceticism, with denial, with all sorts of other mishigasim that really do not resonate with the Jewish way. There's a funny story that they tell of John Kennedy when he was President of the United States and he was negotiating with Nikita Khrushchev on this famous business of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they were in the midst of getting to a final resolution of it. And everyone who knew Khrushchev then knew he was a temperamental guy. And just about as they were close to an agreement, he took off his shoe and he banged it on the table and said, I'm not signing this agreement. And Kennedy looked at him and says, why not? He says, because I want you to first sign a side document that Adam was a communist. So Kennedy looked at him and says, what does this have to do with anything here? Khrushchev said, I don't care. You like it, you don't like it, you got to sign it or else the deal is off. So Kennedy said, give me a few minutes. So he goes and calls his rabbi, Cardinal Cushing, and he asks him, he tells him, you know, we're on about, this is a very historic agreement, this is very important, the peace of the world, can I sign the document that Adam was a communist? So Cushing, without even thinking, says, yeah, go tell him to sign, you can sign it, not a problem. Kennedy comes back, he signs it, and everything is fine. I guess you didn't know this part of American history. A few weeks later, Kennedy happened to have attending a reception where Cushing was there, and he went over to him and he said, you know, I had great difficulties with this. Signing a document that Adam was a communist, I asked you, you didn't even think. You just said, yeah, not a problem, go sign it. Can you tell me what was going on in your head? So he said, yeah, it's very simple. I figured like this. Adam had no clothes, he had no house, he couldn't eat meat, and yet he thought he was in paradise. You can say he's a communist. Our problem today is turned on its head. We have homes, we have clothing, we even in places like St. Louis have air conditioning. We certainly have abundance of meat, and yet we don't think that we are in paradise. This, unfortunately, is a reality that has come clear to us in the last little while. In the year 2008, you would not believe this, but based on the fact that previously there may have been 50 books on the subject, in the year 2008, there was an explosion of 4,000 books on the topic of happiness. Somewhere or other, if you ever want to watch trends in society, you can see them very clearly by the books that are being written and the topics they are addressing. A little while earlier, one of the major topics that was being addressed that had not been addressed heretofore by many was the topic of loneliness. So we woke up to the reality that an incredible number of people in America admitted that they were lonely. That 75% of people during the course of their lifetime admitted that they were seriously lonely. And that at any one point in time, 25% of the population admits to being lonely. This is just the tip of the iceberg, because we also have in America, and again it's on a we basis, an epidemic of depression. 1 out of 5. That's serious. Epidemics are with much less than that percentage. 1 out of 5. And try to make sense out of this. We are living in a society where plentifulness is unprecedented, where our freedoms are the envy not only of people in this generation, but of our historical ancestors, who if they knew this, they would give their eye teeth for it. And here we are in a situation where we have almost everything, and yet the very thing that we cherish the most, as a society, somehow or other, it's elusive. We don't have it. And the question is, where did we go wrong? If we did go wrong. So, some people will say that perhaps we have to go backwards a little bit. This is not something that happened in the 21st century. It was starting to happen a little bit earlier. And some people actually place it at the doorstep of a philosophy that is actually faulty at its very core. We have great individuals who were part and parcel of the formation of the United States, which next to Canada is the greatest country in this side of the Atlantic. Israel is the best country for sure in the entire world. But here, the United States is a close second. Good. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, these are the principles upon which the United States was founded. that everyone has the inalienable right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. When you tell people that they have the right to pursue happiness, that's a nice way of saying you have a right to be happy, you put pressure on them. And we didn't realize this until a little while ago, that in fact by telling people that you have a right to be happy, and then if you find out that they are not happy, they feel, what am I doing wrong here? Everyone says I should be happy, and I'm not. And we had a real crisis such that one of the more famous psychologists in the United States, a lady by the name of Leslie Hazelton, great, very well respected, wrote a book called The Right to Be Sad, in which she actually argued very vociferously that human beings should have a right not only to be happy but also to be sad. And she decried what was going on in the United States, namely that there was so much pressure being placed on individuals to be happy, that because they couldn't measure up, they basically looked themselves in the mirror and said, there's something wrong with me for not living up to the American ideal, and they blamed themselves. So she said, you know what, we have to introduce this, the right to be sad. I actually, when I first read this, my reaction was reminiscent of a famous story about a politician who was running for re-election, and he was speaking to the farmers. And he knew that he was in a little bit of trouble because his party had done some good things to the farmers and some bad things. So he began by what he thought was a little bit of honesty. He said, I admit that as a party, on some occasions we have let you down, but on other occasions we have actually done good things for you. And my argument to you is that on balance, we've been okay. So after he finishes his speech, there's a fellow in the back who gets up and he says, sir, I have one thing to say to you about your presentation. If you take one individual and you put one of his feet in ice cold water, and you take his other foot and you put it in boiling hot water, on balance he's okay, but he's in bad shape. And a society which needs to buffet the problem of the dearth of happiness with let's introduce sadness is in bad shape. In other words, we're out of balance, we're out of whack. One of the interesting features of this is something that will surprise you a little bit. And I recommend to you very highly, if you do get a hold of it, an article by Laurie Gottlieb in Atlantic Monthly. It actually came out just a few weeks ago. Laurie Gottlieb is the lady who became famous or infamous when she suggested that in many instances where people do not find their right match, that they should settle. Settling for Mr. Not-So-Right. She got into a lot of trouble for it. An interesting thesis, not for the time now. She actually attacks vehemently the culture of self-esteem. Self-esteem now is an interesting word. Again, if you look back in psychology, years and years ago, this was a non-existent terminology. But the idea that people have to have high self-esteem has become a major issue. The extent of it, a little while ago in the United States, they do these funny surveys. They had a survey to try to find out which is the worst elementary school in the United States. And they found actually a school in California around the corner from the Burnback Studios where Jay Leno does his shtick. And this was published. There's the worst school. And then the principal of the school was approached and said, what do you say to this? And the principal said, you know what? I think this was a very terrible thing for the newspapers to do because it's going to damage the kids' self-esteem. So Leno, in his sometimes funny manner, says, I don't know what the guy is worried about. These kids can't read anyway. How are they going to find out? But we have got to the point where sometimes we rush in. If children cry, we have to make sure they don't. You don't have to stop them right away. Even this syndrome that you have, which I know is well-intentioned, but we have this business where if, God forbid, anything happens, horrific, like in Columbine or in other places, and we've had our instances in Canada too, that the first thing you hear is counselors are rushing to the scene to help the kids. I have spoken to many of my friends who are in the mental health profession, and they too say, you know, I understand the motivation, but what's wrong with letting kids cry? What's wrong with letting kids experience the pain of loss? What, immediately to go over to them and, you know, to coddle them to make sure that they're going to be going home okay? Let them be broken up. Let them feel the sadness. Let them feel the pain. Rather than to make believe that it really didn't happen or whatever. We did the same thing a little while ago with this ugly thing that happened in New York. We should let kids experience the pain, because we are becoming more and more aware of the fact that the moment you try to eliminate from the kids the full range of emotions, and you say, you know, we have to protect them from all these things because it's not to be good for their development, we're basically going against nature. Because it's natural for people to cry when they lose something. For kids, it's natural to cry if the balloon punctures. Or if the parents told them that they can't stay up at night because they were cranky at the table. You learn. And this is an important thing, because if you don't experience the pain, then you won't experience the other. If your whole life is just a life of a jolly ride into happiness, it's going to be killed. What has happened in our society is quite fascinating. There are people who are obsessed with the idea of being happy all the time. So one of the drugs of choice, and it's not by accident, it's called ecstasy. Because it says if we are obliged to pursue happiness, so I got a better idea. There we can go one step higher than happiness. Ecstasy is even better than happiness. And we could do it perpetually. It's a craziness. It's an obsession that we have created. You know, there's an interesting observation that was made by Viktor Frankl. He talked about an experiment that was done with rats. I often marvel at why we always go make the simple jump. If it works on rats, then it must say something about human beings. That's the way it seems to work. And they basically, what they did, that they attached electrodes to the brain of rats. And any time a rat felt hungry, all they had to do was go to the electrodes. They were trained to push a button, and a current would go through the brain, and they would feel like they just had a 7-course meal. I'm sure you'd like to do this on Yom Kippur. So the experiment went on for 3 days, and after the third day, all the rats were found dead. You know why they were dead? Because they didn't bother eating. Every time they were hungry, they just pressed a button. What's the message? The message very simply is, you can cause an individual to be happy. You can cause an individual to be satisfied. You can cause an individual to be satiated. But what they need is not causes, they need reasons. And if you don't have the reason for it, then the cause is artificial. We have this in the Torah, where it tells us that even though we know that wine will make someone very happy, but a Kohen who has to go and minister in the Beit HaMikdash in a state of happiness, he's not allowed to drink wine beforehand. So you wonder, hold on a minute, the Kohen's got to be happy when he's doing it, wine makes you happy. So we got a beautiful meeting ground over here. Have some wine. Actually mandate that you have to have wine before you start. And the Torah says, nothing doing. You can't do it. Because it said, we want Kohanim to be happy, but not artificially. We want them to be happy because they really are happy. So, having said all this, We now get to a very interesting question. Is there an ideal human being somewhere in the United States who fulfills all of the requirements to be a perfectly happy human being? Is there such a thing? Because once you have that, you say, okay, and I want to be like that individual. So, believe it or not, Gallup actually polled 372,000 Americans to try to find out from them what is the ideally happy individual. And they came up with an interesting conglomerate. This is the sum total of the wisdom of 372,000 individuals, I guess, placed into a computer, and out came the following mix. The ideal happy individual is someone who is slightly above average height. You got that so far? He's Oriental, over 65, I'm good on that one, married with kids, right? Lives in Hawaii, makes slightly over $120,000 a year, and the last one is going to surprise you, and is an Orthodox Jew. Out of 372,000, this is the conglomerate that he came up with. But then, miracle upon miracles, they actually found that guy. There was a guy in Hawaii, his name is Alvin Wong. How did Alvin Wong become Jewish? He converted. He converted, he became Jewish. Alvin Wong is an Orthodox Jew, over 65, lives in Hawaii, quintessential happy individual. But we can't be like Alvin Wong, all of us. We can't all live in Hawaii. We can't all aspire to that stuff. But it's quite interesting that in the mix, and the 372,000 Americans, you wonder, are there that many Orthodox Jews in North America that they could skewer this statistic to the point where this would be the general conclusion of such a massive amount of people? It's incredible. So somehow or other, there's this correlation in the minds of other individuals, which we should have in mind, for example, when we're rushing to get ready for Shabbos, and you know, it's a lot of pressure, you have to get done in a certain amount of time, especially in the winter time, you just got home from work, and it's difficult, and you wonder, you know what, some people probably in the back of their mind, they're saying, you know what, if I wasn't that religious, I wouldn't have to worry about this, I'd be a lot better off. Remember Alvin Wong. You wouldn't be better off. This Orthodox Jewishness has a lot to do with discipline, and it has a lot to do with values. And I would suggest to you that the values really are values that are right there for us to see. The values, there are 4,000 books that have been written on happiness in the year 2008, but none of them is as good as our book. And I'm not saying this in a triumphalist way. I'm telling it to you straight in terms of the wisdom that is there, not only in the Torah, but also in the Gemara and things later on. So let's take a few of them that we maybe do not appreciate fully, but in the context of what's going on now, are very important. For example, we know something called Eva Arvin Simcha B'Simcha, which is to say you don't mix up two Simchas together. So someone will say, hold it a minute, we're having a wedding tonight, and the family's going to be here anyway, let's do the Bar Mitzvah also. Or something of that nature. So generally speaking, the Gemara tells us we don't mix them up. Really what it means simply is that on Sukkot, for example, or on Pesach, you wouldn't schedule a wedding in Chol HaMoed. Even though you say, you know what, it's the ideal time, everybody's happy anyway. Nothing doing. The reason why you can't do it is simply speaking, if you mix them up, you don't appreciate each one on its own uniquely and fully and completely. So it's all part of this, let's spread the joy. Why condense it? Let's have more of these happy days. It's right there, right in front of our eyes to see. Then you have other situations. I know people are going to raise the question, well, don't we have individuals who have fasted throughout their life as a way of saintliness, I can't answer all the situations. Obviously, there are questions with regard to this. But I would like to share with you a fascinating story that is attributed to the Shamash of the Baal Shem Tov, who was known to have fasted on occasion. So there was a fellow who came to the Shamash of the Baal Shem Tov. He said, you know what, I want to be a holy guy. He didn't say guy, he said, I want to be a holy man, or whatever. And I want to do what your Rebbe does. So he looks at him and says, what does my Rebbe do? He says, well, he fasts. So I want to have his fasting schedule. So I'd like to fast exactly as much as he does. And I figured that that's my inroad into becoming a holy person. So he says to him something quite fascinating. You think that my Rebbe fasts? I'll tell you what he does. After Shabbos, he gets ready on occasion to go out into the mountains to meditate, or into the forest to meditate. So he takes with him a sack with enough bread to keep him going for the entire week. And he goes out, and Friday afternoon he gets ready to go back to the city to celebrate Shabbat, and to his surprise, all of the bread is still there. If you can fast like that, you're good. Message: fasting in itself is not anything magical. And if you do something correctly, then you won't even have an awareness of the fact that you're fasting, because you're so immersed in the things that you're doing that are constructive. That, he said, that type of fasting is okay. But if you're doing it just to subjugate yourself, there's no mitzvah in that. As a matter of fact, it may be just the opposite. Would you believe a Yerushalmi that tells us that one of the first things that we're going to have to answer to God when we come to the world to come will be, God will ask us, I put a lot of things on this earth for you to enjoy. I want to know whether you did enjoy them, and if not, give me an answer as to why not. Whether it is true or not, this is a great apocryphal story about Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who in his last days begged his Talmidim to take him to see the Alps. And they looked at him and said, what's going on here? He said, you know, you're in the last days of your life. Why is this even a consideration? And he told them something which was real fascinating. He said, you know, you may have heard this story. It's repeated in many books that have been written these days. They said, I know that in a few more days I'm going to meet my maker. And my maker might ask me many questions. And one of them may say, Rev Shimshon, did you see my wonderful Alps? I don't want to disappoint God and say no. Who thinks like that? But that's the way Rav Shimshon and Foyle Hirsch thought. To think that God put the stuff here on this world for us to enjoy, we have no right to play games and say we're going to do exactly the opposite of what God's intentions were. But there is a very important caveat in all this. That caveat comes through in the Rambam on how we celebrate Yom Tov. So Rambam makes a very interesting observation. He says that we have an obligation to celebrate Yom Tov, right? So how do we celebrate Yom Tov? We're very practical. We celebrate it, v'samachta, to rejoice. What are the things that make us happy? Things that we probably wouldn't have had in abundance otherwise, but we go out of our way to make sure we have on Yom Tov. Wine is one of them, and the other one is meat. So we have to wine and meat on Yom Tov. So Rambam makes a very fascinating observation. He says that if a person thinks that they fulfill their obligation of the samachta b'chagecha, of rejoicing on the Yom Tov, by having all this meat and wine on his own, he's mistaken. This is not a rejoicing of the Yom Tov, this is a rejoicing of your gastrointestinal system. That's not what the Torah asks you for. The Torah asks you to rejoice. So how do you do that? By inviting other people over. Then it's transmuted from a narcissistic exercise into a transcending exercise. It's magical. It's all it takes. Something that will bring you happiness. And lo and behold, what have we found in our generation? Precisely this message. The message that in surveys of countries, what is interesting is that if you want to find a good correlation between happiness and something else, the something else is less likely to be the GDP, the gross domestic product, and more likely to be how much charity the people of that city or country give. An amazing thing that the more tzedakah you give, the happier you're going to be. It's a fascinating thing. We don't think along those lines and say, well, you know, the more I give, the less I have, the less I have, the more deprived I will be, the less happy I will be. Narishkeit. It doesn't work. It's just the opposite. And this is right there in black and white for all of us to see. So, very important for us to understand that happiness is not something that if we pursue it, we're going to attain it. And the mistake that was made originally and been implanted in our heads is that if you go on a straight line and you say, this is my focus, I'm going to reach it. And because it's the American way that, you know, if you want to do this, you want to do that, you want to attain it, you will do so. It works when it's a goal, but it doesn't work necessarily with all those emotions. Emotions don't work the same way as tangible goals. In a book that I highly recommend to you, it's called The Happiness Advantage, written by Sean Achor. He's a fellow who teaches at Harvard, and it's a fascinating study. He had to convince Harvard to give this course, which was about, it was about positive psychology, and which obviously happiness came into it. That course had 1,000 students in the university where the people were giving him a hard time as to actually starting it. This is not academic excellence. This is airy-fairy stuff. Turns out not so. And he makes a very interesting observation. He says that we have it a little bit backwards. We sometimes say, you know what, if only I had a job, I would be happy. He says it works the reverse. If you are happy, you're more likely to get the job. And that works with all the way through life. We think there is actually a spike up. When people get the things that they want, they are happy for a day or two or three. But then, unfortunately, they go back to the original patterns. So the important thing is for people to have good reasons to be happy rather than causes. A cause like a spike up or a drug or whatever the case may be will not do it. More, and I want to emphasize this because I think it's very important for the period of time that we are in. Talmud reports on mixed messages with regard to happiness. In Shlomo HaMelech once, at one point in time, is saying, it was Choy Kamati Mehulol. I have great praise for being happy. On another occasion, he says, V'lesimcha mazu osa. What's this all about? What's the meaning of this? On this, the Talmud mediates by saying there's a difference between the simcha of mitzvah and the simcha that is not of mitzvah. In other words, if you're rejoicing in the fulfillment of something, then that's a rejoicing that is worthwhile. Because you're doing something, you're actually enhancing the world, and you have good reason, therefore, to be happy. But otherwise, it's just, simply speaking, enjoying yourself at the expense of. So now we have to get back to the very important question. So what mitzvot should we embrace in order to be happy? We don't have to go far, because we know that the highest value that we can attain in life is to emulate God. Ze keli v'anveyu, this is my God and I will emulate him, which is the Talmudic understanding of what it means. So, what is it that the Talmud asks of us to do in order to be emulators of God? Well, put on tefillin every morning. That's a great thing to do, but that's not what's in there. It's all, interestingly, sharing values. Ma hu chanu nafata chanu. Just like God is kind, you be kind. Ma hu malbish haruim avto malbish haruim. Just like God clothes those who are in need of clothing, you do the same thing. You, in other words, in talking about the highest value that we can attain in terms of godliness, it's by kindness. It's by sharing. It's by being a transcending individual who has gone beyond his own self and says, I want to embrace the totality. I want to make the world a better place. Because that's what God is all about. That's what we're supposed to be all about. It turns out that this Simcha Shel Mitzvah, this fundamental, shall we say, outstanding, penultimate mitzvah, is the one that now they're just around about to find out is the one that's going to make us all much happier, which is quite nice. But once again, as in so many other instances, they are rediscovering the wheel that we were churning for generations. Unfortunately, we lived in horrible times historically where as much as we tried to be happy, as much as we tried, we were being brutalized for thousands of years until the great redemptive act of the reestablishment of the State of Israel, which has not given us a free ride because there's still people who want to do the work of the anti-Semites of the generations. But we certainly have the opportunity of building like we haven't had before for the last 2,000 years. There's some interesting correlations between that and the period that we are in. On a personal level, the Talmud tells us that whoever can remain happy in spite of the privations and tribulations that come upon them actually brings salvation to the world. And you may ask yourself psychologically, what type of a dynamic is going on here? Well, the dynamic is that this person is saying that I am asserting in front of you that there is a meaning to the world in spite of the tsuros that I've gone through. And I refuse to believe that because of the tsuros that I am going through, that I have nothing more to aspire to. And why this brings salvation to the world is because it's a comeuppance to everyone who thinks that their ability to actually enjoy life is predicated on them on their having only joyous moments and not sad ones. So if you can't cry, you can't laugh. Because if you're laughing all the time, then you're not a human being, you're a clown. And finally, Kol HaMisabel al Yerushalayim Zocha V'Roa B'Simchaso. It's a very interesting thing. This is the thing we're about to do now, which unfortunately people don't embrace as much as they should. The idea on a public level that if we actually cry for the destruction of Jerusalem, we will merit seeing its redemption. Again, how does this work? An entire community that laments what it once had and appreciates its importance, what it's going to do is cry it back into existence. Because if you say, you know what, Farfalon, it's nothing anymore, it doesn't matter to me, and unfortunately many, many Jews are thinking that way today, don't bother me with this stuff, we're okay now, it's not the case. The more we lament what could have been, what should have been, the better off we're going to be in terms of confronting the future. The more that we do what the Edelmans have done with the terrible tragedy that befell them and the community is to say, we're going to cry over this. We're not going to make believe it didn't happen and to have this artificial smile. We're actually going to lament to the point where we are going to do constructive things in the memory of our dear daughter. Don't you think that that makes a difference in terms of making this a better place? We see it right before our very eyes. So the ultimate answer to the question, are we as happy as we should be? It's obviously, I could have told you right away, the answer is no. But the other part of it is that we could change that very easily. If we stop focusing on trying to be happy, artificially or whatever other way, and just focused on doing the things that we're obliged to do, then hopefully we'll all be like Alvin Wong, even though we only live in St. Louis. Thank you very much. So we're supposed to have time for questions, or you want to do Myra? Rabbi? Right?
It's too early for Myra.
Too early for Myra? Not in Ottawa. That's okay. Our son doesn't is not as brutal as it is here. More than happy to entertain some questions. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, no, so I hear what you're saying. So it's precisely because of, I don't want to get into that now because that's sort of like a separate parsha, why that all happened and the etz of your renunciation. The same thing God said to Adam, Arurah adama ba'avurecha, which is quite interesting. The words, the earth is sort of held back, which the word arur, are for your sake, in other words. Because if things are too easy, you won't appreciate it, right? That same dynamic happened with regard to childbirth. But precisely because it was introduced in childbirth, God said, okay, if that's the case, I can't make this obligatory upon women because then they would have to go through it because they were obliged to. So they have children because they choose to do so, not because they are mandated that they have to. The pain is there, but the obligation is removed because of that. Okay? I guess that means you're all happy. Yes?
We have one question. In your analysis of a perfectly happy person, I want to know how they found an above average or height oriental.
So that's a very it's a very good question. But I would imagine since there are so few of them, they actually stood out. Right. But it's interesting that in the conglomerate, it says not above average, but slightly above average. Slightly. Very cute question. Yes. A 1,000% right, and I'm happy you brought that up too. I was very careful at the beginning to say that we're talking about social trends, right? Social trends do not explain individual circumstances, right? So we know a lot more now than we used to about depression, but it's more important to us to understand societally why it's such a preponderance when in fact, this is an age of plenty that is unprecedented. But you're 100% right. It's the same thing as, for example, we know, and I hate using this analogy, but it's not such a bad analogy. We know that one of the reasons why in Ontario, which is the province that I live in, 1 in 10 people has diabetes, right? So we know that one of the reasons is because they're overweight, right? But that doesn't explain every instance of diabetes. We know as a social trend that if everyone cut down on their sugar and they did more exercise, that the rate of diabetes would go down. But that doesn't mean it would be eliminated, and it doesn't mean that people who, let's say, have a disposition towards it or whatever it may be that could explain it, like a chemical imbalance or whatever the case may be, it's not going to eliminate it, right? But when you say this, you're speaking about something generically. It's not pointing a finger at anyone and saying, you know, you have diabetes because you overate. No one has the right to say that. But we know that as a social trend, demographically, you can predict that if everyone does embrace a healthier diet, that the rate would go down. But it wouldn't disappear. So you understand it?
Right, but then you can also say that the fact that there's one in every five people who has dealt with depression or is dealing with depression, that's a social trend, and you can't, and if, let's say, even half of those people have induced chemical imbalance, you can't say, well, if you're going to be kind or emulate God, you will not have that chemical imbalance.
All right, so nobody's suggesting that. I'm just saying that, generally speaking, the way to happiness, if in fact is not to desire it, not to pursue it, not to run after it, but to do things, in other words, to embrace a meaningful and purposeful life, and to forget, always to be oblivious to it, and this will come as a byproduct. In other words, we found out is that happiness is not something that you pursue, it's something that has to ensue, right? And that's the big difference. Will it clear up every instance of people feeling unhappy? Absolutely not. But I guarantee you that it will make a lot of people happier. Because Alfred Adler, the famous story of someone who came to him claiming that he was depressed. So he said to him, and again, this doesn't solve the situation for everyone. He said, I have a cure for you. He said, and be careful, it has nothing to do, again, with chemical imbalances, it probably wouldn't help. But he said, I want you for the next 2 weeks, when you wake up in the morning, for the first half an hour, just think about what you can do for other people. And do that for 2 weeks, for half an hour in the morning. And he said to him, I guarantee you in 2 weeks your depression will go away. I wouldn't generically say this to everyone, but that's an insight on his part, which basically correlates with what I told you before. Yeah?
I remember learning that in the Torah, the word happiness does not exist. That happiness, like you said, that happiness comes about by doing good deeds for other people. And that's what makes us happy. I always thought that was very interesting, that the word happiness does not exist.
Right. The number of words in it that don't exist in the Torah, that's one of them. Somebody could argue, say, v'samachta, that you should rejoice. That's not necessarily happiness, because happiness is a state of being, right? Which probably comes from doing the things that we're supposed to do. It's also very likely that the word love is not in the Torah. Liking. Like, for example, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha doesn't mean love your fellow as you love yourself. It means like them, ahava. But correct, whoever taught you, you can't demand a tuition refund. Yes, there was a hand in the back. Okay, yeah. Well, the one thing, you know, we had in Pirkei Avot yesterday, I think it was Rabbi Shimon who said, Al tehi rosha b'fnei atzmocha, do not consider yourself wicked. Which is a nice way of saying, if you consider yourself to be bad, for example, then you will justify everything bad because you say, well, what do you want from me? I'm a bad guy. Right? So you can't do that. But on the other hand, to say that I am the greatest and I don't need to continue to strive is also the wrong dynamic. So we have this minimalist thing. Don't come into a self awareness that is negative, because that will actually be a self-fulfilling prophecy. What you need to do is to think of yourself as full of the potential to do good, right? And then you come back to the funny thing that also is in this Pirkei Avos conglomerate about all these great sages, where they say, Im lamadeto Torah harbe al tarzik tova la'asmachon ki lekach notzorto, which translated means, if you studied a lot of Torah, don't pat yourself on the back and say, I'm a good guy, because this is why you're here. In other words, we don't need this constant affirmation that you're good, you're good, you're good. A kid comes home from a school having failed in class, and what's the parents' reaction? My parents, I remember when I came home after I failed math, they blasted me. I was prevented from going to see a Yankees baseball game as a punishment. I'm serious. Today, if that happens, the more likely thing is that the parents are going to go to the school, blame the teacher for being a crummy teacher, and says, how dare you fail my kid in math when my kid would be 100% in math? You are the failure, right? So the generations have changed, and we've become so protectionist. In a sense, it's almost like a self-protection, because you're saying, you know, if you say that my kid is a failure, that means I'm a failure. I'm not going to accept that, and my kid's not a failure. But if we tell kids, hold it a minute, if you would pull up your socks, you would do a lot better, and we're not standing for this, and there's no monkeying around, we work hard in order to tell you, send you to school, that's a lot more healthy in the end. The kid may feel a little bit bad in the beginning. I didn't feel great when I was punished. And I also like to say, you know what, if the teacher could only talk English, I would understand it better. But there was no excuses made, right? If we expect excellence from our kids, and we don't settle, and we don't say to them, you know, you're really okay, and there's everybody else around that's no good, because we're sending the wrong signal. And then if a kid says, you know what, no matter what I do, even if I fail, I'm going to be okay. So why is there an incentive to do good? If I'm great in failure, so why do I have to even bother with success? So why do you think that we have mediocrity today? That's unfortunately part of this terrible cult of self-esteem that has gone haywire. And it's nonsense, because kids don't have to be constantly patted on the back. You know what happens? It becomes like an addiction. And then afterwards, you know, hold it, just a second. Today my parents didn't tell me I'm great, so maybe I'm not so great. You know, it feeds on itself. So we do the natural things. I know that in certain cultures, and I've heard from people complaining that sometimes, you know, my parents never did this, that, or the other. It's important for parents to convey to their children how much they love them. That's unconditional. But that's not the same as saying to them that no matter how bad you do, you're really good, as opposed to saying, you know what, if you didn't do well, it's your fault, nobody else to blame, you take the responsibility on your shoulders, and it's up to you to improve. And that way you'll get a lot better product. Not only individually, but also societally. I hope that I answer your question. You think so? Maybe. Possibly. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff, for coming. Enjoyed by Volkov. Down in Mara, downstairs.